Put your glasses up. See your life. Books of books in a pile in the back.
Hey. Welcome to the fourth thrilling episode of Two Writers Slinging Yang, the podcast where two writers, one always named Jeff Perlman, talk writing, reporting, digging, leads, transitions, on and on. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a former Sports Illustrated writer. I'm a Bleacher Report contributor. I'm the author of 7 books, and I'm probably the world's biggest Hall & Oates fan. The music you're hearing is The Dead Poets from the great MC White Owl. And today's guest is a departure, because it's the first time in 4 episodes that I'm going non-sports. Paul Kane is the Washington Post senior congressional correspondent and a columnist. His column about the 115th Congress, PK Capital, appears throughout the week and on Sundays. And most important, Paul, who you can follow on Twitter at PK Capital, is a Delaware Blue Hen, which means he and I actually attended the University of Delaware together at the same time, which makes him an ideal guest for Two Writers Slinging Yang. Okay, so Paul, first of all, thank you for, you're my 4th guest, but you are,
wow.
Yeah, you're only number 4, but you're the first non-sports guest, and most importantly, Paul, you're the first fellow Delaware Blue Hen, and I think that's,
Blue Hens.
And here's what I want to start with. This is, even though we have all this stuff going on, politics, I was thinking about something that kind of fascinates me, which is this. You and I, we both worked at the student newspaper, the Review. We came up in an era where the goal, you know, was to work for a newspaper and then hopefully work for a bigger newspaper and sort of have this career in media. And you know, the Review was a very intense, I'm sure for you, as it was for me, a very intense experience where, you know, we pretty much, it was our fraternity in many ways. You know,
yeah.
it was this newspaper existence. And I wonder now, you graduated in 1992, so stepping back 25 years, which is just weird. It's weird, right?
Crushing.
Isn't it weird?
Yeah. I got my notification over email the other day, a couple months ago, and I was just so busy in work, caught up here inside the Capitol covering Congress, that I initially thought it was my high school president emailing about my 25th high school reunion, and I opened it up, and I said, oh my God. I'm 5 years older than I realized.
Oh my God.
It's my college 25th.
It's weird, isn't it? I wasn't even going to go here, but isn't aging, it's like one of those things when you're 20 something, you see it and it happens to someone else. And then all of a sudden you're in it, you know?
Yeah.
All of a sudden it's happening to you. It's the weirdest thing.
Yeah. No, it's when you look back at pictures from, you know, our Review days and we're all scrawny and either have full heads of hair or have, you know, regular colored hair, not the distinguished set that I have adopted here in my later years.
Yeah, it's strange. So here's my question for you. When you're coming out of college and you desperately want to go into journalism, and now we can, almost like a movie, we can fast forward 25 years. Was it worth it? Like, has this career been what you wanted? Has journalism been what you wanted? Was it worth the pursuit?
I don't have to hesitate. Yeah, it has been. It's been great. You know, I'm not going to lie and say it's for everyone. Everyone should do this. That's not the case. You know, it's not the case with any sort of career. But for me, it has been without question. You know, I've told the story a lot. While I was on campus, sophomore or junior year, I took a pre-law class that the greatest professor in poli-sci international relations, Dr. James Soles, offered. And because I figured I was going to be a lawyer, I was a poli-sci major. And I took that class, and it was one of those amazing classes that with an amazing professor where everybody gives a standing ovation at the end of the last lecture. And I was one of those giving the standing ovation, and I remember saying to myself, I hate the law. Oh my God. This professor is incredible, and I still hate the law. And I just took E307, as it was known back then, intro journalism, because it was a writing requirement. I had to get a writing requirement the final 2 years of college. And that's when I got caught into the buzz of understanding what I really wanted to do. I didn't want to be a corporate lawyer. I wanted to write about the people that make the laws and what goes into shaping those people and shaping the laws. You know, you had always drifted into sports when we were on campus. I immediately drifted into politics and the administration, and I was covering the Delaware Faculty Senate and the university president, Dr. Roselle, back then. So I just immediately gravitated to that stuff. And, I came down to Washington 22 years ago. And still then in my mindset, I probably thought that, my goal would be to slingshot to a bigger regional metro paper like the Philly Inquirer or the Boston Globe and go cover City Hall or something like that. But it just sort of, I bounced in a couple different directions here and ended up inside the Washington Post. At a time when things were really down on an ebb, and now we're just sort of seeing a totally different rebirth of both the organization where I'm in and I think the entire craft in a way. So yes, that was a long answer, but without question, this is worth it.
Are you allowed to think out loud what's going on right now in politics is fucking batshit crazy? Like, are you allowed to express that? Like, this is insane. Like, this is crazy. Or do you, as a Washington Post journalist, do you have to maintain a level of hovering above that does not allow you to offer that exact opinion?
I would not offer that exact opinion myself. Mm-hmm. But I think I have plenty of experience and sort of a freedom in what I'm doing these days to be able to explain that, yes, this is quite different than any recent period of time in American history, particularly as it relates to the executive and legislative branch interactions and how screwy things are. I might not express myself in as colorful a way as you did, but for certain it is, it's unlike any recent time. And I was here for impeachment and Bill Clinton. And, the craziest days of that era were, still so far probably a little bit crazier than we're going through right now. Not saying, we still have a ways to go to figure out this era, but overall, there's just a different sort of insanity and unpredictability. And I think in large part, it's just because you have a president and most of the West Wing are people who just sort of have never done this before. They haven't even, most of them haven't even helped run a rank and file Senate office, let alone an entire administration.
Right, right. So it's really interesting. You have a beat. Like when I covered Major League Baseball, when I was at SI, I was covering 400 guys at the same time. Because you're covering, mm-hmm. You're covering Barry Bonds and Sammy Sosa, but you're also covering the backup catcher for the Diamondbacks. And mm-hmm. you're covering Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, but you're also covering Dana Rohrabacher and, Dara Issa. How do you go about this? Like, how do you cover such a huge scope of America with one keypad?
I think that's, I think that that's one thing that I have, younger people come up to cover the Capitol, I try to make that point, but I haven't always been great at it. The one thing that I always try to tell them and I try to live by is understanding the meetings that happen where the big decisions are made. More often than not, it's the entire Republican caucus in the room. So Senator Luther Strange from Alabama, who's only been here a couple months, he's the successor to Jeff Sessions, the appointee. He's in the room just as much as Lindsey Graham or John McCain are in that room as the decisions are being made. And you have to sort of learn and tell yourself, I got to go talk to him or her. I got to figure out, what they know. And when the margins are as close as they are on issues like the health care bill that the Senate is trying to pass now, Mitch McConnell has two votes to spare. And that makes every single vote that much more important. So, you know, we sent my colleague Dave Weigel to Kansas to find out that Jerry Moran, this sort of usually go-along, get-along type of Republican, he's really pissed off about the health care bill. And right now, as it's crafted, he wouldn't vote for it. And that was a huge bellwether moment where we realized, my gosh, if this guy Jerry Moran's not going to vote for the bill, it's really damaged. You know, so I have to sort of remind myself to sort of pick out moments where I'm like, all right, go find somebody who is not the usual, not the usually quoted suspect, who's not usually on the Sunday shows, because they have a perspective, you know, by right of constitutional privilege, they have just as much input as Mitch McConnell does, because they get one vote. But they also just have a different perspective and can give you an insight to sort of where things are with the government, and give you a sense of like what's really going on.
Are you at all playing to egos? And what I mean is, everyone knows John McCain. The cameras love John McCain. They love Lindsey Graham. They love Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. If you go up to the, you know, rarely sought out after in a national way, Alabama senator, is there a strategy to that in that he's going to be thrilled that someone's coming up to him?
That cuts both ways sometimes when you're approaching and talking to, you know, the normal rank and file who aren't the regulars on Meet the Press. Sometimes they love the attention, and other times it freaks them out because all of a sudden they know they're going to be quoted in the Washington Post. And if they get quoted in the Washington Post, a producer on one of the network shows might see it and think, well, we got to amplify this and give this more oxygen on our primetime cable show, which then might mean all of a sudden a producer from one of those Sunday shows is calling. And you know, sometimes these guys want to stay below the radar a little bit, especially during really intense national debates.
Right.
So there's both. There are times when there are some senators, I'm not going to lie, there are some that are excited as all get out when, you know, they see me or one of my coworkers talking to them and they think they're going to get quoted. There are other times when they are just running for the hills and just saying, go talk to Lindsey Graham or Chuck Schumer.
Right. How do you feel about that? Like when a guy is running, like when I see clips on TV on MSNBC or Fox or whatever of a reporters waiting and politicians running the other way, I tend to think, my gut reaction is, God, you are such a bunch of cowards. But that's simplistic. That's overly simplistic. No,
it is. Look, you know, we are, you know, there are times when they are, you know, running. There are times when they're actually going to the restroom in one of the hallways that is outside where House Republicans meet, and where the press sort of camps out as they're meeting and having critical decisions that Paul Ryan is trying to figure out whether they have the votes on something. There is a restroom that is literally right down the hall. And sometimes they really are just trying to go to take a pee break. Other times they just, you know, they just don't have an answer to the question. And, you know, there's a free press and there's a First Amendment and I'm all for it, of course. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we should, you know, we have the right to go tackle every member of Congress. And, you know, if their answer to the question is simply, I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to vote. I don't know that it would be great to keep asking the question, but if the answer is going to keep being, I don't know, then, you know, to some extent, I think we browbeat people sometimes that we don't necessarily need to. Once they tell us, you know, we don't know how we're going to vote, or I'm a yes or I'm a no, it's kind of like, all right, we got that answered. Let's focus on the other 240 people who are inside that room.
Right.
So.
Right. That makes sense. I live in California's very interesting 48th district. And my congressman, as I mentioned earlier, is Dana Rohrabacher. And out here, there's like all these heated emotions about Rohrabacher, and kind of like there, it's almost like a mini Trump where people love him. There are marches for him. People hate him. And I was thinking how from afar, we sort of view these people, especially with social media now, as superheroes and supervillains. You know, like there are people who assign Barack Obama with every negative adjective you could think of. And he's this devious, devilish, sinister villain looking to overthrow the world. And then there are people who assign the same to Donald Trump and Dana Rohrabacher and Jeff Sessions and whoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, when you see it as like, I have a friend who works at MSNBC, and he's always so calm about it all. You know, I'll be like, God, do you see what they're doing? And he's like, you got to take the long view. You got to take the long view. And I wonder, when you're so up close, like, do you not see these guys as villainous and virtuous? Is there a long view that you have? Are we as a people overreacting at all to what happens?
I don't know that we're overreacting. Let me answer it in a different fashion. Mm-hmm. I think maybe the single biggest change in American politics over the last 25 years is the way people view their local congressmen. It used to be that when I first started doing politics and ever covered a local congressman, that people hated Congress. They'd be like, you know, what is your overall view of Congress? 40% would say it's okay. 55 to 60 would say, nah, it sucks. But then you would ask the follow-up question, a pollster would say, but are you going to reelect do you feel like your local congressman should be reelected? 75% would say, yeah, I love my local congressman. My guy is great. And it lasted that way, well into the 2000s, somewhere around 2006 or so, which was sort of the first big political anti-wave that came about. You started to see that question change. The overall popularity of Congress began to crash, where before it might have been 40% that approved of the job they were doing and 50 that disapproved. It all of a sudden went down to 20 and then 15 and then 10. And then as that was sort of the leading indicator. And then you started asking the question about what about your local congressman, and where it used to be 60 or 70% loved their local guy or their local woman. That now has cratered down into, I think, the 30s the last time I looked. And it is everybody's sort of big view of Congress has shifted so negatively that a guy like Dana Rohrabacher, who sort of skated beneath the radar for the first 20, 25 years in Congress, in the last several years has probably had his own profile in his district explode, go through the roof. Where, you know, people now view him, and they don't view him on the local issue. I remember connecting my brother-in-law in suburban Philadelphia, telling him, hey, if you want to get your post office thing fixed, it's a federal issue. You can't go to your township guys. You got to go to your congressman. And I began to worry that my brother-in-law was going to end up like getting locked up because he started screaming and yelling at these congressional offices. And I know the chief of staff to his local congressman. And I jokingly said, please don't lock up my brother-in-law. And he said, no, we're aware. We got his mailbox issue fixed. They're going to get mail tomorrow. That used to be what people thought of their local congressman. Man, he fixed my mailbox. I'm going to vote for him. Now, they're just looking at Dana Rohrabacher, and you've got a whole bunch of people that are saying now he's just a big apologist for Russia, or, you know, he's a big pro-Trump guy. That's great. So it's become so much more divisive, even down to the local level. And as all of that is happening, it's happening through this sort of social media information, misinformation, as opposed to coming from the local paper. You know, the Orange County Register, I'm not sure they even have any people out here in Washington anymore. They used to have a 2 or 3 person bureau 15 years ago that could really cover Dana Rohrabacher and other members of their delegation, but now you don't have that. So that's sort of a big change, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, it does. It's really fascinating because, you know, Dana Rohrabacher has, just as an example, and a lot of these guys, they have their elections coming up in 2018. And I actually sort of find, so he's decided, he has not had any local town halls. And mm-hmm. people here are killing him for it. And I hate mm-hmm. that he's not having them, but I actually kind of understand it because the optics are so bad nowadays. Why do you want a million people screaming at you in front of a bunch of cameras? It's going to go viral. It just seems like the benefit of even addressing your constituents, while it might be the right thing to do, isn't really there. in a way.
Yeah, that is definitely a factor, and as a lot of these guys are making this decision, I think even Paul Ryan has indicated that he's pretty unwilling to hold a town hall if that's what the result is going to be. And you know, to a certain extent, you know, we as a republic, you know, we elect our representatives to go do our to take what we think are our views and, you know, work on them in Washington. What we get as a right from that is to judge them every 2 years. There is no guarantee that they have to come back and tell you what they think and what they're going to do. You know, the ultimate thing that we have in this country is a vote. It's every 2 years. Now, and from that, we don't necessarily have the right to scream, harass, threaten members of Congress. This isn't Chairman Mao's Cultural Revolution, where we're going to take the people and send them out to the countryside for re-education camp. So, you know, just as it was, there were times where people 8 years ago, during the, you know, August town halls of 2009, I think there were people that crossed the line then in sort of their threatening behaviors toward Democratic members as they considered Obamacare. I think you have some people who are going too far now. But one benefit, I watched a member, a freshman from down in the Newport News area of Virginia. You know, his race last year wasn't even on the map. The Democrats completely missed what was happening in some of these districts. And this was a district that ended up going basically for Hillary Clinton, that had long been a Mitt Romney, John McCain race. They elected this freshman Republican, Scott Taylor, former military guy in his mid-30s, really smart, but also a you know, new age Republican, progressive on issues like gay rights. He did three straight nights of town halls in that area. I went the second night. The first night was one of those sort of bonkers. People were really going crazy and heckling him like mad. I was there the second night, and there was no national TV cameras. There was no CNN. There was no MSNBC. And there was a lot of yelling, and there was a lot of shouting. But man, he stood there for 75 minutes taking the questions. Some of them, yeah, some of them he was dodging. Some of them he wasn't fully answering. But he did it. And I talked to some Democrats afterward who said, huh, okay, style points. I'll give him points for that. And he did a third night. The three nights combined were something like 3,200, 3,300 people that were, and they weeded people out to make sure they were all district residents. He won a lot of kudos early on for doing that and getting that out of the way. And his name doesn't get mentioned nearly as often as somebody that they're going to try and challenge in 2018. So if you do it, you've really got to sort of embrace it and stand there and deal with it. And you might get some upside. It's risky. It's right. A risky strategy. But for some people, it does pay off.
Yeah, that's very interesting. How has the whole sort of fake news, screw the media, we hate these guys, you saw the sort of violent impulses during, you know, a lot of campaign rallies during the presidential election. How has that impacted you?
It hasn't, you know, it mostly hasn't impacted me directly. You know, this year, most of this year, I have spent in the Capitol covering the various agenda issues. So I haven't been out traveling as much as I did last year when I was on the road for a lot of Senate races and House races. I think, you know, what it does change is just this, the people's trying to understand what the president is doing and thinking. You know, most of the most conservative members of Congress are the House Freedom Caucus. They love the media, the congressional media, more than any group, any subgroup of the United States Congress. They thrive off of the media. They are happy to give away their personal phone numbers. They will text back and forth with you. You know, don't have to go through the communications director, press secretary to get their attention. They're just, you know, come talk to me. They don't care.
Wait, why do they love it so much? You know, Why are they the group?
I think they see it as their leverage point. They can, you know, they go through, they talk through the media to basically tell leadership that they're not bluffing. You know, you get into these meetings and you got five or six people who are saying, well, no, we're really going to be against that bill. And we've got 10 or 15 more who are going to be against that bill. And that's enough to sink it. And sometimes leadership, whether it was Nancy Pelosi, John Boehner, or Paul Ryan, sometimes they're like, yeah, you're just kind of bluffing. But when they use, then they can use the press to basically deliver a message saying, no, we are really against this. And now we're saying it publicly. And once we say it publicly, we're more locked in. It's not just us in a room saying we might vote against something.
Right.
So I think they like to use the press and the Congressional Press Corps to sort of send messages to the leadership, to other wings of the Republican conference. And, you know, and it gives them oxygen. And they, you know, otherwise the life of a rank and file member of the House can be pretty quiet. They can get, there are lots of times where there's not a lot of focus. And I think they see themselves, the Freedom Caucus, as a group that, you know, band together, put 30, 35 of them in the room and stick together. And all of a sudden they are a powerful voice.
Right.
And, you know, Trump can scream fake news all he wants, but, you know, up on the Hill, like I said, the guys who love the media attention the most are the most conservative members of Congress.
That's really funny. Do you think a lot of these guys, or do you see it, you know, obviously you're not giving names here, but do you feel like there's a growing number at all of Republicans in Congress who sort of see Trump's behavior and go, what the fuck? Like, what is it? Is there any of that at all? Do you sense?
Without question. They've never dealt with this before, and they've never dealt with such an unprepared president. And I'm not saying that I think that's just a purely objective statement. This is somebody who had less preparation for the office than anyone. You know, even Barack Obama had 2 full years in the U.S. Senate and on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee before he even headed out to campaign for the presidency. You know, the last two Republican presidents were Bush's, H.W. and W. And, you know, by the time H.W. became president, he had been vice president for 8 years. You know, he had served as the chair of the RNC, the director of the CIA. And W. had just come up through that family lineage. And they knew how to do things. They knew how to nominate people. You know, there's this whole sort of crisis of the State Department and other agencies that they just haven't been able to get people through the Trump vetting system and nominate them and send them up to the Hill. Whereas the Bushes, oh, man, they knew how to do things like that. They knew how to do the basic blocking and tackling, you know. And the Trump doesn't know how to do that. And Reince Priebus was a, you know, 6 years ago, he was a state party chairman of the Wisconsin Republican Party. He's not your standard White House chief of staff. So, yeah, these guys, they're trying to figure out all the contours of the West Wing. And then on any given day or moment, Trump himself will just veer completely off script. You know, there's a long running joke now because in the middle of June, it was supposed to be infrastructure week. And, you know, that was a week that, again, got focused on Russia stuff and my, you know, Twitter fights and everything else. And, you know, each morning somebody in the reporting world or one of the liberals would tweet, hey, infrastructure week's really going well here.
Right.
So they don't know what to do. That's the issue. A lot of people say, you know, they have to stand up to him. And the Republicans sit there and think, well, what exactly does that mean? You know, and they're still trying to figure that out.
It's so fascinating. I feel like I'm a pretty liberal guy, and it's hard for me to feel overly sympathetic. But it just seems like it's almost like you're like, what are we supposed to do here? Like, what are we supposed to do here? I don't know what we're supposed to do here. Are we supposed to scream down our own party's president? But also, wait, in a way, it seems like it's the world's biggest trap, because if you now acknowledge that this guy is not a good president, where you backed him during the election, doesn't that just damn you even worse in many ways?
Yeah, on that political side, it sure does. You know, and they are, you know, their fallback now, what you see this week, as, you know, Don Jr. is tweeting out all these emails, which none of which make him look good. Besides the general befuddlement, the reaction is simply, you know, there's an ongoing investigation by Bob Mueller, and, you know, we hope he continues his work, and the Senate Intelligence Committee is conducting its own investigation. And that seems like a dodge, but at the same time, it is reality. You know, there's even the, aside from a few House Democrats, there's nobody that's calling for impeachment right now.
Right.
Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are very, very public and firm. Like, no, we don't want to, there's no, we don't have that yet.
Right.
So everybody's sort of in this maze of, well, what the hell are we supposed to do while all of this is going on? And Mitch McConnell's answer to that is, well, we just keep plodding along, and we're going to try and do this, we're going to do health care, and then we're going to stick around for a couple extra weeks, a bunch of nominations, and sort of almost pretend like it's not happening.
Right. Well, you've covered McConnell for a while now, and
yeah.
During the whole Merrick Garland Supreme Court thing, I thought to myself, but again, I'm just a novice from the outside, I thought, there's no way this works. Like, there's no way this is going to work. And from a purely political standpoint, it just seemed genius. And I wonder, when you were covering this and you were watching McConnell and watching the mechanisms, did you think, wow, this might work? Or do you think this is a horrible idea? Or what were you thinking as it was occurring?
So initially, you know, I remember where I was the night Scalia died. I remember, you know, the moment McConnell, and within an hour or two, declared that the seat would stay vacant. And I remember thinking, that's just unsustainable, you know. And the Democrat, I thought, you know, the Democrats will just utterly, you know, savage him. And you know, I also thought that Democrats would use this as a way to sort of really put Obama back on the ballot, given that Obama was increasingly popular and Trump and Hillary were increasingly unpopular throughout the whole thing. And I thought, you know, this is a way to go into African American neighborhoods in Philadelphia and Cleveland and other key cities and say, this is your last vote for Barack Obama. They're trying to steal his Supreme Court seat. Instead, I don't know, the Democrats just kind of played it straight, as if they thought that getting, you know, newspaper editorials in Cedar Rapids, Iowa was the pressure point. And instead, McConnell played it as just pure raw politics. And, you know, I traveled to, I don't know, 7 different states for Senate races last year. And everywhere I went, every Republican always talked about that vacant Supreme Court seat. They said to conserve, it was their play to conservatives of, and remember one final thing. There's a vacant Supreme Court seat. And if Hillary Clinton is elected president, your last chance of having a check on that seat is a Republican Senate. That was what they all thought they were doing, basically. They all thought that they were, you know, using it as a check against Hillary as president to get them elected.
Right.
And instead, I think it helped elect Trump, because the conservatives also saw that as, well, you know, the real evangelical conservatives, I mean, they voted in bigger numbers, if the exit polls are right, they voted in bigger numbers for Donald Trump. Evangelical conservatives voting for, you know, a thrice married New York liberal on a lot of issues. They voted for him over more than they did for Mitt Romney. You know, it was an ingenious move by McConnell that, you know, Democrats both curse and swear at and get really angry about. And then also in their, you know, private moments, they tip their hat and they go, man, he pulled it off. My God, you know, what an amazing thing.
Right.
I interviewed McConnell in February, and he said the night that he was at the White House and they introduced Neil Gorsuch, he said it was one of the finest nights of his 30 or 40 years in American politics that night.
That's amazing.
And he
That's amazing. That's amazing because it was so, like you said, it was so clear. It wasn't like he was trying to really hide what was going on there. It was very clear.
Oh, it was transparent. Yeah. It was transparent. He, you know, when he wants to say something, get something done, there's little transparent, there's little hidden in McConnell or his motives. Yep. He will say things sometimes that people just blink and go, did he really just say that? My single biggest goal is to keep Barack Obama from having a second term. He's like, yeah, that's true. That's my goal.
That's amazing.
And he did it. And he did it with Garland and Gorsuch. You know, look, I think that should, people want to call it the Garland seat or the Scalia seat. I think it's the McConnell seat.
Yeah, that's well said. I'd like to talk a little writing here. 2015, I have a lead in front of me that you wrote that I really enjoyed. In fact, it's so funny. We came up at the University of Delaware, and we came up under guys like Dennis Jackson and Chuck Stone and Harris Ross. And I kind of, when I read this, I actually thought of our professors reviewing it and saying, that's a really good lead, which is, I'll just read it real quick. Joe Biden had one final bit of advice, a warning really for these very successful students. No matter how accomplished their lives turned out to be, they would not be able to control their fates. Reality is a way of intruding, the vice president told thousands of graduating Yale University students 2 weeks ago. Biden spent the next several minutes unfurling a story he had told hundreds, if not thousands of times before. His improbable 1972 Senate victory, the car crash that took his wife and daughter, the week spent coaxing his two young sons toward recovery. What the crowd didn't know was that reality had again intruded in the vice president's life. Hiding behind a pair of aviator sunglasses that played along with the irreverent traditions of Yale Class Day, Biden delivered the speech knowing that his eldest son was dying of cancer, the same son whose injuries in the crash forced Biden in 1973 to take the Senate oath in a hospital room beside his son's bed. First of all, that's really good. Like, so good. And I know it's weird to compliment a lead from 2 years ago. I'm going to take you back in time a little. How did you... I love the process of writing and the process of how you think about stuff. Like, how did that happen?
So in the spring of 2015, we had realized at the Washington Post that we did not have a pre-written obituary of Joe Biden, the vice president. To those out there who are listening going, what? People forget this. We pre-write obits of really important people, especially when they get a little bit older.
Wait, Paul, I want to interrupt and just, I don't want to brag, but I did write the obituary for Loretta Lynn's husband for the Nashville Tennessean in 1996. So I don't want to steal your thunder, but I was the one who wrote it. You probably read it. You're probably aware of it. It's pretty strong material. Anyway, go ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah. So they gave me the assignment as somebody who had, you know, known Biden since, I don't know, the late 90s, covering the Senate. And so I set out to write this Joe Biden obituary. But in the process of doing the reporting for that, I found out that I was going to be writing a different obituary first, that they were keeping it pretty much a secret, that Bo's cancer had returned.
And how did you find that out, Paul?
From people that were close to Biden that just sort of took it on a act of faith and trust. And they just sort of said, listen, you need to understand something. You need to understand what's going on right now. And here's what he's dealing with. And it was all sort of given to me in a very deep background, off the record sort of context. I wasn't able to report it. I wasn't able to write much about it, but I was able to sort of mentally prepare. And that was on a Saturday. And the person who told me this said, tomorrow afternoon, he is delivering this speech at Yale that they have, unknowing what was happening with Bo, the Yale students had written and said, we know your personal story and we want to hear how you, you know, went through such tragedy and overcame that. So that next afternoon, I went on the Yale site and watched it streaming video. One of the few people who probably watched, who was either in attendance or watched, knowing what he was going through. So it was only 2 weeks later, on a Saturday night when Bo passed, that I sat down at my computer and just wrote a quick, straight news story, probably 300 or 400 words. And the next morning is when I got up and I said, and his advisors, Biden's advisors, had told me days before Beau's death, they had said that they felt like that speech was one of the single best crystallizations of Joe Biden's life, his journey, his politics, and everything. And I realized that that would be the prism for which I could sort of take you from the two bookends of his most important moments of this guy's life, his incredible 1972 Senate election victory, which is followed by this terrible crash that takes his wife and his daughter. And then, flash forward to 2015 as he's near the end of his vice presidency and again has this tragedy. I just thought that that speech was the real sort of crystallization of that. And that's how I got to that.
Oh,
So
yeah, that's
it
awesome.
was, yeah.
Did you think, do you think if the his son had not passed, Biden would have run in the last election?
So here's the Shakespearean type of side of all this is Joe Biden was a well-liked vice president all the way through into 2015. But then what happened with Beau and the grace through which he carried himself throughout that summer and fall, there was an amazing appearance on the Colbert Show. Where
Yeah.
he talked about it. He talked about the death. He talked about things. His stutter actually reappeared on the Colbert Show. If you ever watch that clip closely, you'll see that something he overcame while he was in high school, a bad stutter, was coming back at certain moments. The rawness of all that took him from being a well-liked person to being a just, beloved person. His approval ratings and favorability ratings were higher than the president's actually for most of the last year in office.
Right.
Michelle Obama, I think, was the only one. If you did polling and looked at it, Michelle was the only one who usually did better than Joe. So that's what made it even more compelling for him as a presidential figure that he had to go through this, but. That also made it more difficult and almost impossible for him to run
Right.
because he still spent most of 2015 in just grief. A couple months after he backed out, he did an October Rose Garden. October 2015 Rose Garden, he announces with President Obama at his side that he's not going to run. A couple months later, he's here in the Capitol for a Dick Cheney event. He was sort of the only Democrat that was willing to go to this Dick Cheney bust unveiling. And as he was speaking and he was funny and he was long-winded and he was going sideways and all over the map, it was vintage Biden. Midway through, he started to thank Lynn Cheney for family had done after Beau passed away. I don't know exactly what it was. I think there were cards and letters and donations to Beau's foundation, stuff that the Cheney family did out of respect to Biden. He started to break down halfway through talking about that with looking at Lynn Cheney. And then he just stopped and jumped into a complete segue into a story about what it was like to be a freshman Democrat in the Senate in 1973, a story that he has told 10,000 times before, maybe 100,000 times. It was sort of like his safety move, jump into that and talk about that rather than continuing to talk about Beau, because if he did, he was going to break down in public. I don't think, given where he was emotionally, had he run for president, had he gone through the town halls and had he listened to people talking to him and thanking him and all, I just think he wasn't emotionally there. He wasn't capable of running without just completely breaking down at various moments. All of which might have, in a weird way, might have made him more likable and more possible to win. Because, there's nothing more appealing to voters right now than a normal human person. But I don't think it was there for him. The timing was right, and that's why it's like so Shakespearean. I have to say it that way.
Yeah.
You know, to lose his son and to have that become, to make him such a more humanized, more real person, but at the same time, it made it so emotionally impossible to run.
Yeah, that was a hell of an answer. I actually really love the video. I've watched this about 5 times. I'm a little weird political junkie, where he swears in Marco Rubio, and Marco Rubio comes in, and you know, Marco Rubio just, you know, spent months bashing Obama, you know, running for the nominee, and he goes, Marco, and then he's so nice with the guy's kids. I feel like the more people see that, or there's a video of Tim Russert hosting a Q&A with Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, and the two guys talking about how good friends they became. And I wish we as a people could see more of that, because I feel like we need it, you know?
That is something that has definitely changed up here about what, you know, there still exists these some personal bonds, some personal interactions. Tonight on the Mall, Bob Casey's Pennsylvania Senate office is a Democratic office is having their annual Keystone Cup softball game with Pat Toomey's Republican Pennsylvania Senate office, and it's all in good fun and good cheer. But overall, the relationships have really sort of just deteriorated. There's just not the same bonds, and part of that is just a generational turnover. There have been so many new senators that have come in. You know, at the start of this year, out of the 100 senators, I think 50 or so had only been here under Barack Obama as president. You start doing the numbers like that, and you realize it's such a new place. So maybe those bonds will come together, but it just doesn't seem like it's anything the way it used to be. And that sort of the personality bonds that guys like Ted Kennedy used that could sort of almost overrule anybody. Sometimes his own Democratic leader, Ted Kennedy, would just roll because he had so many friends on the Republican side, and he had his committee, and he could just roll people through his own personal power, personality. That just doesn't happen anymore. Right. And that's a big change.
Right. Let me ask you a final question. On the one hand, we have, you know, a president who sort of takes on the media nonstop, and fake news has become this big hashtag and blah, blah, blah. And on the other hand, I recently likened, and I'm not alone, I'm sure, what the Washington Post and the New York Times are doing in their political coverage to watching Ali Frazier just go back and forth and back and forth in a great way. I mean, I'm always going to one paper, then the other paper, then the other paper. Are we witnessing in an odd way, even with all the layoffs at places like ESPN, you know, Fox, blah, 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 are we witnessing a rebirth of political journalism to a certain degree?
Yes and no. On our level, you know, the Post is blessed that, you know, we have a owner in Jeff Bezos who is, you know, worth a bajillion dollars, and who, you know, what seemed almost like a lark almost 4 years ago when he decided to buy the place, has become a real sort of personal pride for Bezos. He sees it as a not resurrected, but a organization that was sort of listless, floating in the ocean, and now is, you know, a full running machine that is, you know, not just writing stories and breaking incredible stories about this president, but, you know, covering everything, every inch of the healthcare debate on the Hill, to expanded sports coverage, to just having a bigger gusto to it and getting more readers than we ever could have imagined. And I think the Times is going through that as well. And they're, you know, combined, we're getting more readers than either of our institutions could have suspected. So that part of it is, you know, 6 years ago, the Post was in a, you know, just a, I don't know, a bad spot. We'd gone through so many rounds of buyouts, forced buyouts, you know, what one editor called back alley buyouts, you know, hey, thank you for your service. It's been great. Take this money and please leave. To now we're just, you know, expanding and more coverage into the White House, into Congress, into federal agencies. But I do still worry about the local, regional, metro papers, because that's where, you know, there's only so much the Washington Post can do. There's 435 members of the House of Representatives. There's 100 U.S. senators. There's 50 governors. State legislatures everywhere. City councils. We can't cover all of those. We need, you know, local, state-based entities to still be out there and covering away and covering and uncovering corruption. You know, 12 years or so ago, a couple of guys at the San Diego Union Tribune broke a story about their local congressman, Duke Cunningham, whose home was bought by lobbyists at 100% markup for like $2 million instead of what should have been $1 million. And together they unraveled an amazing story in which this guy had a local defense contractor based in Southern California who literally had a bribe menu. He had a menu, a cocktail napkin that was like 1 million equals 25 million in defense earmarks. It was incredible.
Right.
Within a couple of years, both of those reporters were gone from the paper. And I don't think that the San Diego Union Tribune has much of any presence here left in California, left in Washington. Yep. And if it does, it's probably like a shared reporter with other news outlets. And I fear that those papers are continuing to shrink, and that means less and less focus on the local congressman, on the local mayor, on the state senator, and the governor. So that's my long-term fear.
Yeah, that's a bummer. Well, I'm going to no, it is. It's I mean, I'm a newspaper.
I know.
We all entered this business going into newspapers. That's what we did when we came out of college. And now
I should have started. I should have ended it differently. I should have gone with local depressing and then end on happy note.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to, you know, my reminder to people, don't just subscribe to the Washington Post and the New York Times. Go buy your local paper. That's what I say to everybody.
Well, Paul, I want to wrap this with a tweet. I just saw that Donald Trump tweeted today. He said, the White House, the WH is functioning perfectly, focused on health care, tax cuts reform, and many other things. And then he added, I have very little time for watching TV. So all's good in the hood. He's all good. Paul, you know, as a, I have to say, as a guy who worked with you at the college paper, it is, I'm being sincere when I say this, it is a thrill to sort of see what your career has become and sort of, there are survivors like us who have lasted in journalism and, you know, makes me proud to be a product of the old review. So thank you for, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, that goes both ways. I still remember the day that this skinny kid showed up in the review with a story about how Delaware refused to play Delaware State because Del State was the traditionally African-American school. And I remember looking at the editor saying, is this really true? Because if so, it's kind of a big story. your career turned out pretty good, buddy.
Yeah, well, thank you. Again, I want to thank Paul Kane from the Washington Post for Slinging Yang today. Two Writers Slinging Yang can be heard on Bumpers at Bumpers FM or downloaded on iTunes. If you enjoyed this, please consider leaving a review. And if you have any guests you'd like for future episodes, hit me up at angold22@gmail.com or Twitter at Jeff Perlman. Thanks to MC White Owl for the beats. Thanks to Paul Kane of the Washington Post for the time. And until next week, please keep writing.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.